Just let me hear some of that rock and roll music. Any old way you choose it.
That was the Beatles doing rock and roll music, which started their concert at Crosley Field on Sunday, August 21st, 1966, 50 years ago. I'm John Keysweater. Tonight you'll hear all about the Crosley Field Show, their second and last Cincinnati concert, including details of the rain delay from the night before. You'll hear radio legends Dusty Rhodes and Jim LaBarbera. Joe Santangelo shares the business side of the concert. Can you really lose money on a Beatles show? And you'll hear from three Beatles fans, Bev Oldhouse, Phil Nuxhall, and Tom Sandman. Scott Belmer, author of the book The Beatles Invade Cincinnati 1964 and 66, also drops by. For the next 2 hours, we celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Beatles concert at Crosley Field. Years before he was elected Hamilton County Auditor, Dusty Rhodes was one of the WSAI good guys who introduced the Beatles to the Cincinnati airwaves back in 1963. Dusty was the city's first Beatlemaniac. He started Cincy's first Beatles fan club for his WSAI listeners in January 1964, about a month before the Beatles came to America and played Ed Sullivan. So when you first heard the Beatles in late 63, what'd you think?
I thought it was something fresh and new and kind of exciting. Everything seemed to have gotten into a rut. Do you remember what the number one record was in December of 63?
No, you'll tell me.
I will. Dominique by the Singing Nun. And then in January, number one was There I Said It Again by Bobby Vinton, a throwback to the 40s. So everything had kind of slowed down, and for obvious reasons, after the assassination of President Kennedy. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, comes this sound. It's fresh, it's new, it's different. They've got long hair, they've got accents, they're mysterious and unknown, and it was just a moment in time.
So their first hit was, number one hit would have been in January of 64.
Right, I Want to Hold Your Hand. And you know, the interesting thing is at WSAI, the first week we put it on the chart was B-A-T-T-L-E-S, misspelled it, and it went to number one the next week, and we got the spelling right.
And soon after that, you had the idea to do a Cincinnati Beatles fan club, right?
Exactly, and this came to me on the air one night. I said, hey, let's do it, and we always called it North America's first Beatles fan club. I don't know, nobody's ever disproved it, but we were right up there with them. And all of a sudden, the mail comes flooding in, and it's one of these, what the heck do we do now? Well, fortunately, Dick Bethel was the Capitol Records promoter who was stopping by the station, and I got Dick to get Capitol to pay for printing up the cards.
Little blue ID cards,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, people still have them. And some of the gals that hung around the station took on the job of sending them all out and keeping the list. In fact, the Beatle Boosters Club is still going now. The gal who was running it passed away kind of suddenly, but the club is still going. They've got the list that I gave them of all those members, but it was a deluge, and the interest was way
up. It just really exploded.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, like we say, they were really, in some ways, very original, but they were bringing back some of our music that we had overlooked, and that was the interesting thing about it. You got songs that some of the soul artists put out that we never paid any attention to.
Some Chuck Berry, too, right?
Sure, sure. And Act Naturally, the Buck Owens song that Ringo sang. And, you know, they just sort of opened it all up. But these British kids were so impressed by American music while they were growing up that became a part of them. And then they gave it back to us in a different context that really took over.
Looking back 50 plus years, do you think Cincinnati's experience, the immediate love affair with the Beatles, was typical of cities across the nation, or was it something special here in Cincinnati?
Well, I think it was special only in that we were fortunate enough to get them here on their first American tour. But the interest was, from what I heard across the country, was very, very big. But because we had them coming here, that made it even more so. And it was a Beatles summer.
That's right, because the first hits in January, you start the fan club. In February, they're on Ed Sullivan twice, I think, in 3 weeks.
Yep.
Then in April, you've got the deal in place for them to come to play Cincinnati Gardens.
Right, right. And that just was magic because Dick Purton was out with a couple of the other guys, and they came back to the station and said, we're going to try and get the Beatles. Are you in? And I said, sure. They sent a telegram to NEMS in England. And about 4 or 5 weeks later, a telegram came back and said, you got them. And then, talk about panic, what do we do now? And fortunately, Dick, who is Paul Purton here, but Dick Purton for many years in Detroit radio, knew Dino Santangelo, who was a promoter of the Ohio Valley Jazz Festival. They served in the reserves together, and fortunately we tied up with him, and he just took care of...
And it was a case where the tickets went on sale within weeks, gone.
Yeah, oh, quicker than that, yeah. $550 was the top price.
So they played the Gardens that August. No air conditioning, right?
Right. Remember?
And when you look at the 64 concert versus the 66 concert, there's so many differences. One is 13,000, you sell out the Gardens instantly.
Right.
And yet 2 years later, they come to play Crosley Field in August of 66, and it's only like roughly 15,000 people there.
I think it was the idea that they were really new, and I think some of that faded, although the love of their music didn't, and the fans were still there. But after that, I think it's just the newness, that shock-type effect, had kind of worn off a little. And as I understand it, their last concert was at Candlestick Park in San Francisco, the last one they did, and that didn't sell out. Can you believe that? Some of these things are just, they're hard to comprehend. Like, well, for example, the Rolling Stones appeared in Omaha to 600 people before their first hit. But I think the people that would go to the concerts kind of backed off a little. They weren't new, they weren't fresh. And although their music was constantly evolving. But of course, that's the other problem. The kind of things they started recording later on couldn't be done that well on a soundstage.
You get into Sgt. Pepper's and Magical Mystery Tour. There's no way you can do that on a tour.
Right.
The one thing that I did find as a constant between the 64 and the 66 concert is each of them was only about 30 minutes.
Right. Isn't that amazing?
You go to a McCartney show today, he'll play 2.5, 3 hours.
Right. The warm-up shows that gave him a little bit more, but... And the other thing that, when you look back on it, is the equipment they had. I mean, the kind of equipment they had at the Gardens wouldn't be acceptable to a rock band today. You know, they came in with a truck full of stuff, and they had these Altec speakers, and that was it.
Well, you know, the 66 concert was a rainout on Saturday night. They come back on Sunday, and they had so little equipment that they were able to play at 1:30 here at Crosley Field and play Sportsman Park in St. Louis that night. I mean, because they had so very little to get from one place to the other to play.
Yeah, today you got truck after truck after truck of stuff. And the thing about them was so great. They were obviously enjoying the heck out of themselves. They're very easy to talk to and kind of bemused by it all, but just enjoying the moment.
So to do a 30-minute concert... But I'm thinking then most of their singles were probably only, what, 3 minutes?
Sure.
A little bit more than 3 minutes would be a long single.
Yeah. I think they did 12 songs. I've got the music list tucked away. And some of that was album material, too. And that was another thing that was interesting because until they hit Top 40 radio, which got started in the mid-50s, we only play 40 singles. And that was it. And at the end of the week, you get a few new ones, some weeks more than others. But that was the Top 40 format. We actually worked off a stack of 45s. When you played one, you put it back, and that's how we worked. Well, the Beatles started playing album cuts because of the Beatles, because of the interest and everything. They drove us to that. So they kind of expanded the Top 40 a little bit in that way.
And also the A-side, B-side. I mean, they had hits on both sides of some of them.
Yeah, those records would be in the studio, and if you flipped one over, you'd immediately be on the carpet. But when the Beatles came in, you had to do it. You had to flip them over.
We'll turn back the clock again to early 1964. And I've been up to the old SAI building at West 8th and Matheson before it was torn down. And I, you know, there was this big picture window that overlooked from Price Hill down onto Cincinnati. And it had an aluminum strip holding the window in place. And I'd seen in it, you know, I love Ringo. I love Paul. So the fans, mostly teenage girls, would come up and stand outside your window and watch you do the show.
Right, exactly. They'd stand out there, and then they'd write on that, and they, of course, would hold signs up or holler or wave. It was a great location, too. Super place to have a station.
Again, with the perspective of 50 years, do you look back and look at the staying powers of the Beatles' total catalog?
Oh, yeah. It's so really crazy because young people today even know who the Beatles are and know their music. And are, to some degree, I wouldn't say they're wild fans, but they like it.
My son just graduated from UC. He took a course last fall, the History of the Beatles, a weekly class.
It was a cultural event, and you can read deeper implications into, I'm sure, in the college would. But they say that the music kind of started the civil rights movement because it broke down with the African-American artists that were so good that people were listening. And the Beatles came in and expanded things a little bit farther. And I think what they did was the different types of music they play and what they drew on. Like Eleanor Rigby is a classical piece. Yesterday has been recorded 3,000 times and is a easy listening standard now. And then they were doing stuff like Dizzy Miss Lizzie, which was first done by Larry Williams. But they kind of opened it up. For those that thought that rock and roll was two guitars and a set of drums, they made that all different and busted it open. And I think that was really a fascinating contribution, as well as the idea of the Love Generation and all that that came later.
Your wonderful memory is sitting in that room underneath the Cincinnati Gardens with these fun-loving, we can't believe we're here kind of guys.
Right.
And then doing the show and hustling in the car and getting out of town.
Yeah. It was just it was a magic moment and one that really took the city by storm. It certainly made a lot of us at the radio station very well known and made the radio station very successful.
Scott Belmer is the expert on the Beatles' visits to Cincinnati, the 1964 Cincinnati Gardens, and the 66 Crosley Field concerts. In 2014, he published a book called The Beatles Invade Cincinnati, 1964-1966, and you've written more than a dozen other books, including The Making of Sgt. Pepper, George Harrison, His Words, Wit, and Wisdom, Black Market Beatles, Beatles Artifacts, Beatles Christmas books, and a Jimi Hendrix book in there for some reason. Let's talk about the 1966 concert. First of all, that was the two-day event because of the rainout on Saturday night, correct?
That's correct. They were supposed to play at 8 o'clock on Saturday, but the rain just came down. There was thunder, there was lightning. The promoters had failed to put a canopy up, which was part of the contract. So the stage got wet, fans got wet. The Beatles refused to play. They were afraid for their lives.
So did anybody play?
Well, there's one report that said the Circle came out and did Red Rubber Ball, and then that was it. It was too dangerous. They were wet. They were afraid of the lightning. So after about 2 hours, they canceled the event.
And then everybody came back the next day, and they did the same thing.
Well, not everybody came back. There were at least 2,000 fans that didn't come back the next day. And that's why when you see photos of the stadium, you see a lot of empty seats.
But still, Crosley Field capacity was like at 29,000 or so. I remember seeing in your book that the capacity for the concert was going to be 23,000, but only like about 15,000?
About 15,000. They're not sure. Between 12 and 15,000. Probably closer to 12,000.
But still, 15,000 doesn't seem like much for like one of the biggest bands on earth.
Well, there's a problem this summer because of the John Lennon statement that the Beatles were bigger than Jesus, and that kept a lot of people away. So the Beatles were waning. They were tired of touring. They were done. And this would be the last year the Beatles would tour. And then the San Francisco concert at Candlestick Park was the end of the Beatles touring.
So actually, the Beatles had arrived like at 3 o'clock in the morning, Saturday morning, in from Memphis, right?
That's correct. That caused some controversy because there was all these press people there and photographers and fans who wanted to talk to the Beatles.
And teenage girls.
And teenage girls. Some girls bought like these expensive flowers they were going to give to the Beatles. And the Beatles got in their limousine and drove off, didn't talk to the press, didn't talk to the girls. They were gone, and everyone was unhappy.
And they went to Vernon Manor.
They went to Vernon Manor. They crashed there. They had breakfast and then hung out, supposedly. We don't know a lot of what they were doing during the day.
And then they went to Crosley Field. They were actually there on site.
They're there waiting in the dressing room with the other acts. There were four opening acts. And they're waiting and waiting and for the rain to subside. And the circle finally went out, did one song, and decided that was it.
And do you know much about how they would come back the next day? I mean, was it a case if they didn't play, they didn't get paid?
Well, supposedly, that's right. The promoters were desperate to get their money back. And the Beatles agreed for an extra amount of money. I'm not sure. I'm thinking $60,000 to play the next day. And then the Beatles played the next day during a very hot, sunny, humid August day. And then after the concert, they got in the plane and flew to St. Louis, where it rained in St. Louis, too. But they had a canopy, so they played.
So that's the only time in the Beatles' history they played two concerts in two cities one day.
That's correct, yes.
That could be done because they didn't have much equipment on the stage, right?
No. They had some small Vox speakers, the drum kit, some microphone stands, and some wiring. I mean, imagine putting a concert on today like that. Impossible.
But the concert that they played on Sunday wasn't that long, as I recall.
Well, none of the Beatle concerts were very long, usually between 28 to 30 minutes. And that would all depend on how fast they would go through the songs or if they had any banter between songs. Very short concert. Imagine now paying to go see a concert and having your main group play for only 30 minutes.
I was looking at the ticket prices. The top ticket was $550 from the ticket you've got reprinted in your book.
That's correct. $350 to $550, if you can imagine that.
And it said $1 for the bleachers, although some of the pictures I've seen in your book, there was nobody in the right field bleachers.
No. And the thing was, the stage they played on was 100 feet away from the nearest fan. I mean, there was a disconnect there. I don't even know how they even felt connected to the fans being that far
away. So they had to be about out by second base.
That's right. They were.
This tour started in Chicago, right?
It started in Chicago on August 12th. They had two shows there in Chicago. I think there were four cities they played two shows, afternoon and evening.
Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland. But even before, this was their last North American tour.
That's correct. Although no one knew it at the time, but they were pretty much fed up with touring. Especially what happened in the Philippines. They did two concerts in the Philippines, and they were supposed to go see the Marcos family, you know, the dictators running the country. Well, they snubbed them. They didn't want to do it. So after the concert, they got roughed up by the bodyguards of Marcos. They took all the money that they were paid for the concert. The Marcos family took that money. Mal Evans got beat up. He was the roadie for the Beatles. And I think George got punched. And they were happy to get out of there with their lives. And the world tour for 66 started in June, I believe. And that was shortly after they had a new single out, Paperback Writer and Rain.
So that's the songs they were hawking at
that point. Right, that was another number one hit for the Beatles.
Paperback Writer. Paperback writer.
and his clinging wife doesn't understand. His son is working for the Daily Mail. It's a steady job, but he wants to be a paperback writer. Paperback writer!
Then the album that came out that summer in America was called Yesterday and Today.
And that had two different covers.
That's right. Well, the first cover became known as the Butcher cover. So it had the Beatles in white frocks with baby doll parts and hunks of raw meat sitting on their shoulders and laps.
Like they were butchers.
They did that because they felt Capitol Records in America was butchering their albums. Because they would take songs from this album and that album and make a whole new album to make more money. And the Beatles were opposed to that, but they couldn't stop it.
So then the other one, as I recall, it had something like them sitting around like an open trunk or an open suitcase?
That's right. It was called the trunk cover. And that became the standard Yesterday and Today album.
In the book, you quote George Harrison as saying, in those days, all we had were three amps, three guitars, a set of drums. Were they flying with this equipment or was it trucked there? It's about a 7 or 8 hour drive to St. Louis, I would imagine.
Well, it was trucked. And got to understand, there wasn't much equipment back then. And most of fans could barely hear the Beatles anyway over the screaming.
I've heard from others that the people who promoted the concert joked that they were the only ones to lose money on the concert was the Cincinnati concert because they had double the costs for one concert.
That's right. You know, and you know, promoters were, you know, obviously very upset, but they had no choice. You know, after the show was canceled Saturday night, many fans went to the ticket windows to get their money back, and there was no one there. And they were upset. They didn't know what to do. And it was only later announced that you could use your ticket stubs for the next day.
And I saw one of the reports, it might have been Dale Stevens in the Post, that said that people who didn't have their ticket or lost them or whatever were kept off to the side, not allowed in, until it got like 15 minutes before showtime. Then they let them in, figuring that there weren't going to be that many people who could, quote unquote, sneak in anyway. So
that's right.
When you do different Beatle conventions and Beatle fan things, when they know you're living in Cincinnati, what do they ask you about the Cincinnati concert? Is it the 64? Is it the 66 or both?
Well, a lot of people want to know about the 66 concert because it was one of those concerts that the Beatles played two cities in one day. So that's a unique thing. Plus, also, Gordon Baird, the photographer, local Cincinnati photographer, took some amazing photos of the Beatles on stage. And
there's like about a dozen in your book.
They're featured in the book with his permission. I have a really nice interview with him in the book talking about how he had two rolls of film. That's all he shot. They're incredible shots. He was one, I think, three photographers allowed at the front of the stage.
My former colleague at the Enquirer, Fred Straub, shot it for the Enquirer, and I've seen some of those pictures on the internet, and I guess I saw a reprinted story in your book that he had offered to sell a packet of pictures from the concert.
Right, until about maybe 10 years ago, you could still go to the paper and get prints made. And then a friend of mine actually went to get prints made, and the negatives had disappeared. So no one knows where the negatives are.
So you met with Gordon and you got permission to get a full set of his pictures?
Right. Yes, I did. And with his blessing, we've also done some events together, Beatle events, and sold his prints.
And he said that he kind of just roamed around the stage, was within 2 or 3 feet of the stage, and could literally take whatever he wanted to take.
He had all access, you know. And his one photo of the Beatles coming out from the dugout or the rampway, Very famous photo. It actually appeared in many national magazines and newspapers because it was an iconic image.
And I know that the pictures I remember seeing, I think it was, is it John and Paul? They're in the white with kind of a striped suit, a pinstripe suit or something?
It was actually gray suits with red pinstripes.
And at one point, Paul McCartney noted to, I think, one of the Enquirer writers that he was wearing a red belt because he was in uniform for the day. He knew the Reds obviously wore red. The dressing room had to be the Reds clubhouse, I'm guessing?
I believe it was.
Was not too glorious.
No, it wasn't. You know, and they never had a press conference before this concert. There were a couple of reporters who were allowed in there, but it was all unofficial, and we don't know what questions were asked. We don't have any documents.
They stayed at Vernon Manor. Now, is it true that they took pieces of the sheets or the curtains or the rug or something that where the Beatles stayed, and they were sold or auctioned or given to something like that?
Yes, that's true. A few people actually bribed the hotel staff to buy the sheets and pillowcases. I know one gal who bribed someone to get the tablecloth that the Beatles ate on, and she still has that tablecloth.
I'd done some stories 2 years ago about the 50th anniversary of the 64 concert. My recollection, it was just the four guys and maybe just a small support group flew in. But in one of the stories in your book, I saw that the Beatles entourage was like 65 people.
Well, that included press people, you know, reporters who
flew
with them.
International press?
International, national press, who flew with them on the planes, who had all access. Because back then, they wanted as much press as they could get.
So it wasn't just four guys that landed at 3 o'clock in the morning at Lunkin and made their way to Vernon Manor. We're talking dozen people.
Right. You know, besides the roadies, the managers, the people who took care of them, bodyguards, then you had the press people as well.
On that final tour in 66, was the set list pretty much the same for most of the shows?
Far as I know, nothing changed. It was the same songs in the same order. The Beatles did not rehearse for their concerts. They might play guitar backstage, you know, or whatever, but it was the same set list.
And the warm-up groups, there was The Circle. They had hit the Red Rubber Ball, right?
Red Rubber Ball and Turn Down Day.
I should have known you bid me farewell. There's a lesson to be learned from this, and I learned it very well. Now I know you're not the only starfish in the sea. If I never hear your name again, it's all the same to me. And I think it's gonna be alright. Yeah, the worst is over now. The morning sun is shining like a red rubber ball. You never care for secrets I confide. For you I'm just an ornament, something for your pride. Always running, never caring, that's the life you live. Stolen minutes of your time were all you had to give. And I think it's gonna be alright. Yeah, the worst is over now. The morning sun is shining like a red rubber ball. The stories in the past with nothing to recall. I've got my life to live, and I don't need you at all. The roller coaster ride we took is nearly at an end. I bought my ticket with my tears, that's all I'm gonna spend. And I think it's gonna be alright. Yeah, the worst is over now. The morning sun is shining like a red rubber ball. Oh, I think it's gonna be alright.
Brian Epstein was their manager as well.
So was Epstein on the road with them?
He was with them on the road. He was the Beatles manager. He also managed the Circle. You had the Ronettes, who the Beatles loved, the Ronettes.
Thank you.
Bobby Hebb, who had a hit with Sonny.
Sonny, yesterday my life was filled with rain. Sonny, you smiled at me and really eased the pain. Now the dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true, I love you. Sunny, thank you for the sunshine bouquet. Sunny, thank you for the love you've brought my way. You gave to me your all in all, and now I feel 10 feet tall. Sunny one so true, I love you. Sunny, thank you for the truth you let me see. Sunny, thank you for the facts from A to Z. My life was torn like windblown sand, then a rock was formed when we held hands.
Sunny,
sunny one so true, I love you. Sunny, thank you for that smile upon your face. Sunny, thank you for that gleam that flows with grace. You're my spark of nature's fire. You're my sweet, complete desire. Sunny one so true, yes, I love you. Sunny, yesterday all my life was filled with rain. Sunny, you smiled at me and really, really eased the day. Now the dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true, I love you. I love you. I love you.
And then there were the Remains, who were a minor sensation for a short period of time.
They were the backup for the Ronettes, too?
They did. They played for the Ronettes and Bobby Hebb.
I would lose all my blues if you promised that your love was true now. And I don't know why I keep loving you the way I do now.
So
the rain out. You came back the next day, and one lady emailed me her ticket. It's a half a ticket with a black mark in it, and a black mark made by a felt marker, and that meant she had gone in once, and she was good to come back Sunday. So Sunday noon, how did the afternoon unfold at Crosley Field?
All right, so Sunday at noon, they had the canopy up just in case, which was good because it was a hot, sunny day, so the shade provided some relief to the Beatles. So the opening act started at noon. You had the Remains, the Circle, the Ronettes, Bobby Hebb. And then probably around 1:30, the Beatles came out, did their half hour. The vehicle pulled up behind stage. They got in the vehicle, drove to Lunkin Airport, got on the plane, and flew to St. Louis.
And as you said, they played here in 66 on the 21st, the rain date. By the 29th, it was their last concert in Candlestick. When did Beatle fans learn that they weren't going to tour again? This was the last 10 days of their North American tour. Kind of put the bigger history picture under that.
Well, they never made an announcement, ever. They never said, oh, we're done touring. After the tour in 66, they began work on Strawberry Fields and Penny Lane, and then Sgt. Pepper. Well, you're not going to take Sgt. Pepper out on the road. Just, you're not going to do it. And then 68 was the White Album. 69 was Abbey Road and Let It Be. And that was it. There were many people who tried to get the Beatles to do a concert. They offered them millions of dollars. They just wouldn't do it.
And really, the only one was the rooftop one. Was it Abbey Road at Apple?
That was on Apple Studios, on the rooftop, of course. And that was the last, if you want to call it, public performance by the four Beatles together.
And that would have been 69?
69, yeah.
Joe Santangelo was with his brother Dino, the promoter of the Beatles concert 1966 at Crosley Field. Dino also did the 64 Cincinnati Gardens concert, but you were, what, 17 at the time? You weren't there for that.
No, I was not there for that one, but I was there for the one at Crosley Field.
You were there for Crosley Field, age 19, right?
Yeah.
Helping your brother. You've told me that you might have been the only guys to lose money on a Beatles concert?
I'm pretty sure we were, at least the Beatles, as everybody knows them as the Beatles. The reason being is that not too many people knew, but the concert did well, but it did not do great. We did not sell out. There were probably 6,000 or 7,000 empty seats, even on the Saturday night before the rainout. So it did not do particularly well, but we probably would have broken even. But having the rainout on the Saturday night and then playing again on the Sunday afternoon, and having to pay all the costs twice, the security, the ushers, and so on and so forth, the building costs and everything, that pushed us from probably a break-even situation into a loss.
So you had to basically pay double for the venue and double for the 150 police officers.
Everything was double, in effect, yeah.
So what do you remember that you go to Crosley Field on Saturday, there's supposed to be the Beatles concert, and what, right before the first act came out, it began raining? And
I think it was raining from the get-go, but it just went from bad to worse, and I mean, it was really bad. And there was a man who used to be very popular in the sound business back then. His name was Bill Hanley. And I'll never forget, he was on stage, and the rain had stopped at that point. Now, the stage was drenched because it was not covered, or covered properly. I forget which, to be honest.
I've read not covered.
I think not covered is probably more true. And I remember him with the guitar playing it. And I remember Paul McCartney saying, I am not strapping that electric guitar around me. So, you know.
During the rain period, I guess the Beatles would have been in the Reds clubhouse or in a clubhouse under the stadium.
I honestly don't remember, but they were undercover. But I mean, it really, it was just a torrential downpour.
And then somebody had to convince the Beatles to stay? Or was it
they were actually very cooperative in making good on the date. And they played Sunday afternoon at 1 o'clock. And then they hurried out of town. In fact, they played, I think it was 11 songs, and it was only about a 30, 35-minute show.
Which sounds odd, but then again, when they played 64 at the Gardens, that was only a 30, 35-minute concert.
Right,
That's what a Beatle concert was.
I don't know back then if they could have played for much longer than that. And, you know, rumor has it that in 64, they had hidden help from, the rumor is, I don't know if that's true or not.
You mean
they had another person playing underneath the stage is one of the rumors. I don't know if that's true or not.
Do you remember, I mean, when it was raining like heck, are you running around trying to, how are you helping your brother? Or just
hoping the rain stops. Yeah. I mean, there's not much else to do.
In all the years and all the concerts you promoted, was this Beatles one the only one where you had to postpone and come back the next day?
That's one of the few, yes. It's a very rare event that happens.
The 66 concert, you said, wasn't a sellout.
No.
The books and the things that I've read said about 15,000.
No, I think it was more like 20 or 21,000, but we could have sold 20. I think Crosley Field held 28 or 29,000.
29.
So, yeah, we could have sold a lot more. I even went it was the first time I was ever on an airplane. I went to Charleston, West Virginia. Now, this was obviously before the days of computerized tickets. I went with 200 tickets down there to sell tickets, and I think I sold 196 of them. And came back the same day. And like I said, it was my first time on an airplane because the radio station was intent on selling Beatles tickets. And, you know, that's the way, you know.
It surprised me, even looking at their last tour there in 66, it ended at Candlestick Park in San Francisco. That didn't even sell out. And you think as hugely popular as the Beatles were.
You know, if they were in a bit, you hesitate to say slump in the Beatles in the same sentence. But I mean, they were in a bit of a downturn, if you want to call it, for whatever else. It was before the Sgt. Pepper album, where their popularity went through the roof again. And so it was like, I think there were, you know, there were a couple other acts in that time frame, the Rolling Stones, the Beach Boys, you know, that were kind of competing for that number one spot. And I think it was just a little bit of a downturn period for them.
When the concert was over, the guys get off the stage, they go out the center field gate, and they disappear.
They immediately got into a car and went to the airport.
And was this crowd yelling, screaming? They probably couldn't hear anything anyway?
Probably not, yeah. It was the equivalent. I was fortunate enough in 1990 to do New Kids on the Block at Riverfront Stadium.
Okay, right, right.
And we had 52,000 people for that. You couldn't hear a word of what they were singing.
It wasn't generational. It was the same.
Oh, yeah, it was the same. The screaming was incredible. You know, one of my favorite Beatles stories, after the concert, my brother, in wanting to make sure that the expenses didn't get too out of hand, said, Joe, will you please go over to the hotel and make sure that they're checked out and that everything's okay? So I went over, I went through the rooms, and in John Lennon's room, there was a shirt. And it was a Savile Row shirt, I'll never forget. So I took it, and they were gone. So my brother, being the consummate entrepreneur, said, you know, I wonder if we could sell this. So we ran an ad in the Enquirer, and it said, buy an authentic piece of the Beatles shirt. Send $1 plus 25 cents postage and handling, too. And we took a post office box out on Hyde Park Square at the post office.
Okay.
So about 2 weeks go by, and we're driving home, and my brother says, you know, let's check the box and see if anything happened. So he's in there for the longest time, and all of a sudden, the door opens, and he's dragging a sack, going, Joe, help! And there were 2,000 pieces of mail. So now we got a problem. You know, we promised, and now this, honest to God, was his shirt. So now my father is a tailor. Our father, Dino and I, our father is a tailor. So I'm like, Dad, we need 2,000 pieces of material here. So he dissects the shirt, takes the cuffs apart. There were like four layers of the cuffs. There were four layers on the collar. I mean, it was a fabulous shirt. It was. And we cut that thing up into 2,000 pieces, slapped it on a card, and really, honest to God, was his shirt. So we weren't doing anything, you know, improper. And somewhere out there, there's people that have a little piece of cloth that's about the half inch by a half inch that's actually part of John Lennon's shirt from that concert. Well, I don't know if it's from that concert. No, it wouldn't be because they went right to the airport. But anyway.
But authentic John Lennon shirt.
Absolutely.
In the promotional efforts leading up to the concert, were you partnered with the radio station? I know that Steve Kirk of SAI was,
yes,
was part of it. So was it?
That was the main thrust of getting the word out, was the WSAI good guys and, you know, doing everything with, because Steve was partners with my brother. My understanding is Steve's still got a dollar bill locked up with all four of their signatures.
No kidding.
Yeah,
no kidding.
So ask him about that one.
Phil Nuxall was at the Crosley Field concert for the Beatles back in 1966. He knew the place well because his dad, Joe Nuxall, pitched for the Reds. Phil, you were there with a couple of high school friends, is that it?
Junior high. Yeah, I think there were five of us. And four of the five were really good girl pals, gal pals. And each one of them took on the persona of each of the Beatles. I mean, they were fanatical. So that made this experience even more fun.
So you were just kids and you were able to get tickets to see the Beatles.
Right. Yeah, they were the old paper tickets. And I wish I still had my ticket.
So it was to see the Beatles, but not to see Bobby Hebb or The Circle? No.
The Circle, I really liked. Red Rubber Ball.
Right.
But, oh, no, it was the Beatles.
So
sure.
You get down there on Saturday, and then it rains like
hell. Oh, gosh. Yeah. We were so disappointed. The memory that I have of that evening was after we found out that there was not going to be a concert that night, and we're walking to the car, we're in the parking lot, and I remember Eleanor Rigby blaring everywhere, and it was haunting. It was very, very haunting to me.
Do you recall where your seats were?
I think they were pretty near first base. We were pretty far back. We were not that close.
And then it was a no-brainer. We're coming back the next day to see it when it was announced.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh, yes. We couldn't wait. And it was a beautiful, beautiful day. It was actually kind of a blessing in disguise for us.
And you knew Crosley Field.
Very well. In my sleep, yes.
And you knew that the Beatles were probably going to be in the Reds clubhouse.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. Am I correct? You went to try to find them?
Yeah. This is what happened. I told my friends, I think I know where they're going to hold the Beatles up before the concert. And I was pretty sure. And I said, follow me. And we literally ran to the clubhouse. And the clubhouse was very isolated. Had to know where it was.
It was a ramp off the main concourse under the stands.
At the very end. Yeah. There was this kind of a steep ramp, a two-level ramp that led up to the clubhouse doors. And as soon as we got there, the doors burst open. And one by one, the Beatles came down the ramp. I mean, literally, I would say 3 inches from each of them. And, of course, the girls are screaming at the top of their lungs. And I don't know what I thought. It was very surreal. But to think that we were that close to them. And at the time, we didn't realize what was going to happen with their career. You know, we didn't know if they were going to be a drop in the bucket or what.
They were just a band you liked.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Loved, loved, loved them.
I mean, they kind of, I would imagine they came out kind of quick, or did you get to study their face or see them? Or?
I don't really remember. I just remember they had on the tan, you know, the Beatles suits.
With stripes in them.
Yeah. Actually, I think two of the girls had their hair cut. Like Brenda was Ringo, and she looked like Ringo, and her hair was the same cut. Yeah. I mean, there was no way Dad was going to let me have my hair that long.
When they came by you, did you think, God, they're taller than I thought, thinner than I thought, they're happy, they're...
Definitely thinner than I thought. Well, yeah, taller.
When they were coming down the ramp out of the Reds clubhouse, uh-huh. Did they have their guitars with them, or did they have...
Yes, they had them over their shoulders.
And so then did you have to scramble back out to your seats since they were quickly going to take the stage?
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah. As soon as they were out of sight, we ran back.
For those people who might have seen pictures of what the Reds clubhouse looked like, I would imagine it was this dank, dark,
smelly
cinder block building built onto the edge of the...
No luxuries whatsoever.
So that was the green room for the Beatles.
Yeah, exactly.
So were you a bit of a hero with your friends that you could get...
Well, I was after that. Yeah, that kind of sealed the hero. Not hero, but yeah, that was a thrill.
So what do you remember about them playing the concert?
Well...
Could you hear it?
No, not one single sound. The screaming was nonstop. I can't even describe it, how loud it was. And I couldn't believe that many people could scream that loud for so long. I mean, the entire concert. The only music I remember hearing is, you know, Red Rubber Ball by The Circle. But the actual Beatles, I didn't hear anything. Now, my friend Patty, who was in the group, she had a camera, probably one of those old Instamatics. No, it was the Brownie. And I don't see her that often, but every time I see her, I say, Patty, where are the photos? And every time she says, oh, I know they're somewhere in the house. I will have to look for them. And I'm like, please. So, Patty, if you're listening, please find those pictures.
So are you still a Beatles fan to this day?
I am. I remember we used to have booster buses that would go to basketball games, and you would pay, like, I don't know, 50 cents or a dollar to ride on the booster bus. And it was a regular school bus.
High school?
No, junior high.
Junior high, okay.
Yeah, this was younger. I remember I was on the booster bus with my Beatle girls going up to Oxford, I think Talawanda, to the basketball game, and Beatles were blaring the entire time. And that's such a vivid memory for me. Oh, and then there's my outfit for the concert. I went, I can't remember the name of the store in downtown Hamilton, and got, I thought, the coolest bell-bottom hip-hugger pants. They were brown with tan stripes and this huge belt corduroy with a big buckle. And I couldn't wait to show the family. And Mom took one look at them and she said, "You take those right back. They were too provocative."
I'm John Kiesewetter. Stay with us for the second hour of our celebration of the 50th anniversary of the Beatles concert at Crosley Field. You're going to hear from the music professor, Jim LaBarber, and from two Beatle fans who attended the concert, Bev Oldhouse and Tom Sandman, on 91.7 WVXU.